We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
This stock and commodity report on Illinois Public Media is made possible with support from Bates Commodities in Normal, providing clients with the latest market information based on research by ADM Investor Services and other independent sources. Bates Commodities can be reached at 1-800-383-4647 or on the internet at batescom.net.
From the Land-Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It's the 7th day of May 2010. I'm Todd Gleason. In a few moments, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Mike Zuzolo of Global Commodity Analytics. He's in Lafayette, Indiana. And later in this half hour, we'll discuss the cash grain market with Bruce Bostard, the manager of the Ludlow Co-op Elevator Company out of Ludlow, Illinois. Along the way, we'll take a look at the agricultural news and weather, and we'll hear the fourth and final installment in our Story of Corn series. Today, retired corn breeder Forrest Troyer explores what the industry and consumers can learn from the domestication of one of the globe's most important cereal grains. In the second half hour of our program, on many of these stations and always online at willag.org, we'll hear an encore presentation of our interview with University of Illinois Ag Policy Specialist Bob Thompson. This happens for two reasons. First, I'm not actually here. I'm out of the office today. And secondly, it's a really good preview of how the 2012 Farm Bill debate is setting up in Washington, D.C. So stay with us today. And my thanks ahead of time to the staff at Illinois Public Media for helping out with the program. The Closing Market Report is a production of Illinois Public Media.
Friday afternoon, prices settled like this in Kansas City. May wheat, 512 and a half, up 1 1/4. July, 521, up 1 1/2. September, 532 and a half, up 1 1/2. May wheat at the Board of Trade, $5 1/4, up 3. July, 510 and a half, up 2 1/4. September, 526 and a half, up 2 1/2. May corn, 364 and 3/4, up 3/4. July, 372, up 3/4. December, 386, up 1 1/4. March of 2011, 399, up 1. May soybeans, 951 1/4, up 5 3/4. July, 960, up 6. August, 956 1/4, up 6. September, 941 3/4, up 6 3/4. November, 934 1/4, up 5 1/2. May soybean meal, 276.40, up 20. July, 278.40, unchanged. May soybean oil, 38.13, up 29. July, 38.44, up 32. June live cattle, 95.90, up 5. May feeders settled at 112.42.5, down 92.5. May lean hogs, 88.50, down 52.5 on the day. And those are Friday's settlements in Kansas City and in Chicago.
Agricultural programs are made possible by First Midwest Bank, serving Illinois' agricultural community with locations in Champaign, Danville, Galesburg, Morris, and McHenry. More information is available from Bob Baisdefer in Danville at 217-477-6016. First Midwest Bank, member FDIC, an equal housing lender.
Taking a look at Mike Sola's extended two-state highlights, he says showers and thunderstorms will move across Illinois and Indiana by Saturday afternoon. The heaviest rain will focus on northern locations with isolated field flooding possible. Individual storms could produce locally heavy rainfall south and central, but most locations south of Interstate 74 will pick up less than 1/4 inch of rain. The next significant weather system is indicated to arrive in southwestern Illinois during the middle of next week. The projected track of next week's storms will put the heaviest rainfall from southern Illinois toward east central Indiana. Frost is likely this weekend in northern Illinois and exiting eastern Indiana Monday morning. Damage will be limited by the early growth stage of the corn, but there may be some burn back of leaves. Warmer temperatures will return by early next week, and the outlook for the next 2 weeks places most of the two-state area in above-average temperatures, which will provide excellent growth conditions.
Agricultural information is made possible with support from ADM. ADM thanks America's farmers because everything they do starts with you.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us now for a look at the futures market is Mike Zuzulo of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. Good afternoon, Mike.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Well, I have to say that I thought that grains held up pretty well, and soybeans especially being able to claw its way back, given the fact that the Dow is down over 100 points. And that oil lost its 200-day moving average. What do you think?
Well, I liked it too, Dave, but I'm not going to put too much stock in it because I think we had the frost scare still playing into the market hands. And I think the trade in the corn in particular, I think the trade next week is going to have to contend with, and probably in the beans and wheat to lesser degrees, going to have to contend with getting some questions answered. Among them, did we get a frost? What's the issue with the ethanol mandate as far as the automakers versus what ethanol producers are asking the EPA to increase on? What's the report going to say? And lastly, but not least, what are those outside markets going to tell us Sunday night in China? So I think we bought some time. It looked like a perfect day traders type market today because we had the weakest thing out there, beans, having support for most of the day. So it allowed the traders to come in and trade the short-term charts from the long side in the wheat and in the corn. And then you saw in the last 2 to 3 minutes when we were up, 7 to 8 in wheat, 4 to 5 in corn, all of a sudden everything went negative on the day. We did settle better than those closes, but, at 114, 115, we were down in both July wheat and July corn. So I didn't make too much out of today, but I'm thankful that it wasn't, ugly as it was in the outside markets.
Next Tuesday, USDA will come through with their new estimates for ending stocks for 2009-2010 and their first of the season for 2010-2011. What did you think of the trade estimates, which, by the way, are on our website at willag.org?
I think that the wheat market is going to need some really good news next week, Dave. I was surprised. I'm the low ball number out there at 764 million bushels for the 2010 crop, and the way I got there was that I'm about 225 million bushels more than USDA on their last report for the, like the March 31st report for the exports. They're at 850 million on wheat exports. I'm at 1,075. The 5-year average is right around that billion mark. We have not gone below 900 million in the last 6 years. So for them to be at 850, I think they're a little bit low. But even having said that, I was surprised that 13 of the 18 people that or companies that did the estimates, we were running 950 million bushels or more in terms of trade expectations. So the way I'm going into next week's report is a lot like corn, wheat has some pretty neat lines in the sand here. We've got cash prices supporting, but we also have this report ahead of us, and I like the way the July wheat has been testing that 515 level. If we can break above that after the report on a bullish 2010 ending stocks number, then we may be able to go after those March highs and that 200-day moving average around 536, 540 level. That's where I'd probably get some caught-up hedges done.
How pivotal do you think Sunday night's trade will be?
I think in the outside markets, in terms of how they relate to commodities, they'll be extremely pivotal because if China, my mindset, like we talked about this morning, my mindset is we've got to see China turn the corner. And then if China does, I think Europe will pick up some support off of that. But I was truly amazed that the crude oil is going to lose almost $13 a barrel this week. And I don't think that can be easily shoved under a carpet or shoved under a rug when you're trading the commodities in the grains or and especially the livestock. I would say to you that I would be more worried about the outside markets affecting negatively the hogs and the cattle than I would be the grains right now, especially the corn and the wheat, because like the beans, the hogs are trading extremely great values right now. And so I would liken it to if you don't lock in your hogs here, at least for the summer months, and just book profit, You're essentially turning around away $7.50 to $8 corn if you're a corn farmer. You know, that's the kind of profit we're talking about in the hog sector right now. So that's where I think those outside markets will really come into play Sunday night. If China's not up, Europe's not up, then I'd look for the meat sector to be down first and then the beans to follow, and then we'll have to see what corn and wheat do after that.
The chart that seems at the moment to give me the greatest pause is the S&P 500. Is that the same for you?
Yeah, it really is. You know, and it's funny, you can translate this back to the weekly bean chart, too. If you're a bean producer and you've already taken out your 200-week moving average in your trend line as of this week in meal, and I oftentimes will say to clients and subscribers, I really think that the meal is a leader to the upside and to the downside. So meal did not perform well this week. In fact, the meal lost to the bean oil, even with that 13 or 1250 drop in crude prices, and we lost our support on the weekly chart in meal. So is that a precursor to the beans losing its weekly support? So I would attach the beans with the S&P as far as how important those charts are right now.
So what are the S&P benchmarks we should be watching?
Well, I still think that, you know, based upon what we talked about this morning, I really wanted the June S&P to get back up above 1087. That's the 200-day moving average, or stay above 1087. That's the 200-day moving average. It looks like we're going to close above that. But today's low is 1090.75, so we've still got 45 minutes to have to deal with that. If you want to call a low in the S&P, I think you've got to get back up around that 1135, 1145, and say, okay, we've done the damage we need to do. We had pretty decent jobless claims numbers and unemployment reports today, so the economic data is there, but the charts certainly are not right now.
What are you telling hedgers to do today?
Interesting thing about the corn right now, Dave, I know you like the technicals. If you take a look at the Deese corn chart, we've found a very nice channel that I think corn producers and hedgers should be watching as we go into the report next week. 395 close above in Deese corn would project a 15 to 25 cent push to the upside. 380 close below in Deese futures would suggest, pretty strongly suggest, a push back to the April 27th low of 367 and a quarter. Like the wheat, we've got some big numbers on that USDA report. I noticed that 16 of the 20 analysts out there that put numbers out are at 1.7 billion bushels or more. 5 of the 20 of the analysts are at 2 billion bushels or more for new crop corn. They're really stoking up the yield because of the early planting. I've decided not to do that. I'm going more with the 5-year average on the yield because I'd like to get all the way done planting, and I'd also like to see a couple of crop ratings reports before I really go after historical yields. But the trade is looking for some big numbers next week.
Thank you very much, Mike.
Have a great weekend, Dave, and thank you.
Mike Zuzalo of Global Commodity Analytics, and he is in Lafayette, Indiana.
Support for WILL comes from Stuart Peterson, since 1985 offering strategic commodity consulting and marketing services to help producers manage market opportunities and risks by developing dynamic strategies customized to each client's goals and operation size. More information is at stuart-peterson.com.
In agricultural news, U.S. Senator Joseph Lieberman says a long-awaited bill to reduce pollution that contributes to global warming could be unveiled in the U.S. Senate next week, but likely without the public backing of an influential Republican lawmaker. Nearly 2 weeks ago, Senator Lindsey Graham said he would drop out of the effort if Democrats insisted on moving forward with unrelated immigration reform legislation this year. Without Graham, it is unclear whether Lieberman will be able to lure other Republicans to vote for the climate bill. Lieberman also said that offshore oil drilling provisions of the climate bill were being ironed out in the aftermath of a major Gulf of Mexico oil spill. Meanwhile, more than 250 U.S. scientists yesterday defended climate change research against political assaults and warned that any delay in tackling global warming heightens the risk of a planet-wide catastrophe. The scientists, all members of the U.S. National Academy of Sciences, targeted criticism of those who have been postponing any action against climate change because of alleged problems with research. USDA Secretary Tom Vilsack says that the agency may have to take bigger chances with its business loan guarantees if it is going to finance energy plants that make a real difference in rural America. Vilsack says, quote, "We've got to be willing to take a chance on projects large enough to reverse the economic decline in rural America." But Vilsack also appealed for political support if the agency guarantees some energy projects that don't work out. Vilsack also offered to meet personally with airline executives who want to use more biofuels in their aircraft and are talking about starting a program called Farm to Fly. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says he is committed to taking up food safety legislation before the Senate leaves Washington for its one-week Memorial Day recess, but a number of senators have prepared a number of controversial amendments that they plan to try to add to the measure. Senator Dianne Feinstein wants to ban the common plastic additive known as BPA from being used in food packaging, a measure opposed by food manufacturers. And Senator John Tester may also offer a controversial amendment that would exempt small food manufacturers from new food safety regulations. A new Iowa State University study says if farmers raised the fruit and vegetables eaten in the heartland, they could create thousands of jobs and millions of dollars in income. The study looked at what would happen if farmers in six Midwestern states, Illinois, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, Minnesota, and Wisconsin, raised 28 crops in quantities large enough to meet local demand. It found that if an ample supply of produce could be grown regionally, it would spur $882 million in sales and more than 9,300 jobs and about $395 million in labor income. With Agricultural News, this is Dave Dickey.
And I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason, the host of the Closing Market Report and Commodity Week. Both programs you can hear online anytime you'd like at willag.org. Because I'm not actually in the office today and taking the day off, we produced Commodity Week early, last night, in fact, and you can go get it off our website at willag.org. It's already there. Our panelists in studio, and there was no guest, but the panelists make a great show, included Dan Zwicker of ADM Grain Group, Paul Cooley of ADM Investor Services, and Wayne Nelson of L&M Commodities. Now, up next, the fourth and final installment in our Story of Corn series today, we'll take a look back at the lessons that can be learned from the domestication of maize. If you think about it, says Forrest Troyer, the corn plant has been moved northward more than half a continent. The genetic pool from which it evolved has been sliced and diced by farmers and breeders in North America for about 3,000 years. Most of the selection pressure has come in the last 200 years when the gene pool was divided 1,000 ways, and then more than 99% of those crosses were eliminated. That leaves a very small domesticated gene pool from which corn breeders can draw to improve the crop. Troyer says it is vital, then, that the geneticist and corn breeders understand how that pool was narrowed. He suggests they start by reading the works of Charles Darwin.
Darwin's advice was to study the plant, to look at it sharply, to relate what you're seeing to the information that you've learned about botany, about how a plant works, and then through that decide what it needs to do better. Adaptation is the critical thing. Adaptation is the sole driving force as far as biological evolution is concerned. It's what makes everything happen. And so it makes all the sense in the world to think in terms of how can I make this plant better adapted to get higher yielding, more reliable corns.
The second notion Troyer says corn breeders should think about is the importance of wide adaptation. He says weather is the reason hybrid corn breeders narrowed the gene pool early in the 20th century. It was easier to market and grow a corn which could adapt to widely variable weather conditions.
I think most farmers understand that maybe better than most plant breeders. And so wide adaptation is a very important trait. We can select for this by having more test locations, but by looking the things that don't jump around so much at different locations and different seasons, you know, very high yielding here, very low yielding over here, and so forth. We want those ones that can take the give and take that the environment puts out.
After understanding the relationship of weather to the crop and how it was used to widely adapt the corn plant across the U.S., Troyer believes today's and tomorrow's corn plant breeders will be better able to pinpoint the genetic differences, which could result in an improvement. He also says the gene pool could be expanded by looking into the old crosses and the wild relatives of the corn plant, or by altering it with genes from another organism. To him, the science remains only the science if it is addressed cautiously. In that caution, the world could find another green revolution. For University of Illinois Extension, I'm Todd Gleason.
Support for the Closing Market Report comes from AgriGold Hybrids, featuring the AgriGold Giants, a group of five new hybrids designed to meet the performance standards of yield, health, and consistency required by Midwestern corn growers. More information is at AgriGoldGiants.com or at 800-262-7333.
Joining us now with Cash Grain Analysis is Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op in Ludlow, Illinois. Good afternoon, Bruce.
Good afternoon.
Phone's not ringing, I imagine?
It has been a little quieter today after the market action earlier this week. So, yeah, little less activity.
What did you make of yesterday?
It was a hard market to get a handle on, and the things are chopping around and I have a really hard time with the futures side of the market where it looks like we're really not trading grain fundamentals. We're trading money flow in and out of commodity markets in general. So it's a lot harder to wrap your hands around that.
And how does it impact you in particular in your job?
In our job, we're going to try and stay as even as possible through the day. The biggest impact is trying to decide what to do at 1:15. Do you go home even or do you try and pre-hedge something when you see the market go dramatically higher or dramatically lower in the last 5 minutes? Is that real or is it an aberration? And if it's up, how much are you going to buy? Do you pre-hedge that and will it? The excess that you buy, will it hold when the night session starts in the evening?
Are barges easy or hard to come by at the moment?
Barge freight has ticked up a little bit through the course of the week. You'll see disruptions. It's still not real high, 375 on the Illinois River. But anytime you get high water problems, you're going to have logistics problems. Even on rail this week, we're running late on some trains. The Canadian National shut down for a few days north of Memphis due to high water and some flooding and washout problems. But they're running again. Looks like we'll be loading a train tomorrow.
What about your bids for today, sir?
We are at 353 on nearby corn and 355 for new crop, so that's really flattened out. Beans, 941 on nearby, and 894 slid back below 9 on the new crop, so that's kind of killed the interest there.
About 30 seconds left. What do you think will be the key features for basis next week?
Cash movement and logistical disruptions, I think, will be the thing to watch. How much rain do we get next week, and what does that do to logistics?
Thank you, Bruce.
Thank you.
That's Bruce Bostard of the Ludlow Co-op in Ludlow, Illinois. And in 2 minutes, I'll be back with a look at agricultural weather. It's National Roast Leg of Lamb Day. The first sheep were brought to North America by Spanish soldiers under the command of Cortes in 1519. The introduction of sheep into commercial cattle herds of the Western territories were not well received, causing bloodshed and social division. It's also National Home Brewers Day. Due to a clerical error when Prohibition was repealed with the 21st Amendment, home brewing of beer remained illegal. It was not until February of 1979 when President Jimmy Carter signed a bill repealing federal restrictions on the home brewing of small amounts of beer. On this day in agricultural history in 1660, Isaac B. Firmbein of The Hague reportedly received a patent for macaroni. In 1847, delegates to a national medical convention in Philadelphia approved a resolution that established the American Medical Association. Early goals include launching programs on medical ethics as well as improved public health. And in 1925, William Lever died. In 1886, William and his brother James formed the Lever Brothers Soap Manufacturing Company. It was one of the first companies to manufacture soap from vegetable oils instead of tallow. By 1900, the factory was producing a number of well-recognized brands, including Lifebuoy. And that's this day in agricultural history.
Agricultural programming is made possible by Farm Credit Services of Illinois. Farm Credit Services of Illinois has been providing for farmers' credit and insurance needs for over 90 years, including real estate, operating and machinery loans, crop and life insurance protection, and programs for young and beginning farmers.
You're listening to the Closing Market Report. This is Dave Dickey. Joining us for our look at the agricultural weather is meteorologist Steve Hilberg of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. Good afternoon, Steve.
Good afternoon, Dave.
Is it true I can actually put these two words in the same sentence, freezing and weekend?
Yeah, there's a possibility that we're going to see some frost this weekend with a very cold air mass coming in following this cold front that's coming through this afternoon. And that will at least bring a chance for some frost to the state, most likely on the morning of Sunday morning, when the high will basically be, the center of the high will be moving over Illinois. And so especially up north where it will be a little bit colder, could see some freezing temperatures. But overall, I don't think it should be too bad at this point, but it's something to keep an eye on.
And we have weather over the weekend, some rain coming in, huh?
Actually, we don't look like we'll see any rain until now. Later Monday, We should get the next system moving in here. We got some good rain from this system last night in western and northern Illinois, which actually have been rather dry. We've had some pretty dry weather, but at over an inch and a half in some western counties last night and about three quarters to an inch up in northern Illinois. So those two areas got a good amount of rain. With the front coming through this afternoon, some showers and thunderstorms, of course, will accompany that. But it looks like the worst of the weather is going to be east of here in Indiana and Ohio.
Then we need to see the temperatures begin to warm up. We're going to see that next week?
Yeah, we will. At least for a day or two. There's another system, as I mentioned, coming in Tuesday, and that'll drag a warm front through here, and that will bring some rain Monday night into Tuesday, then some very strong southerly winds, which will warm things up, but with clouds and rain, that will tend to keep temperatures from getting too far above normal, but still mild. And then another front sweeping through later Tuesday and bring another little reinforcement of cool air. But overall, I'd say the week looks sort of damp. Systems are going to be about a day apart. We're going to see rain maybe Tuesday and then again Thursday. So considering it's been rather dry and we need some rain, it's not necessarily a bad thing.
What about 2 weeks out?
Oh, then we're really stretching it. That's pretty much a guess. But the outlook is for weather systems, looks like, to keep moving through here and bring us periodic chances for rain. doesn't look like there's going to be an extended dry period where we're not going to even have a chance for rain. So it looks pretty good for agricultural interests.
What else are you looking at?
Oh, that's pretty much it right now. We've just been really dry. I mean, dew points have been in the 30s this week, so evaporation rates have been really high. And with the sunshine and the winds, it's hard to keep moisture in the soil at this point. But with the rain we've had and what we're going to get over the next week or so, I think we'll be in pretty good shape.
Thanks, Steve.
Okay, Dave.
Meteorologist Steve Hilberg of the Midwestern Regional Climate Center. You've been listening to the Closing Market Report, a production of Illinois Public Media. We'll say goodbye to some of our radio stations now. For the rest of you and online at willegg.org, stay tuned for The Farming World. This is Dave Dickey.
This is The Farming World news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. Early in the month of April, we discussed agricultural politics and policy with U of I's Robert Thompson. It is a very good overview of what's happening in Washington, D.C., and how the issues are lining up for the 2012 Farm Bill debate. Our discussion, which you'll hear as an encore edition today with Dr. Thompson, started by asking him how the Obama administration had been dealing with agricultural issues.
Well, we passed the Farm Bill last year, and which authorizes, of course, our commodity programs for the next 5 years, and it took a couple of years to get that through. But since the Farm Bill was done, I think the priorities of the Obama administration appear to have been much more in the areas of food safety and increasingly rural development, cap and trade, more of the issues that are policy areas that affect agriculture but don't come under the rubric of what we normally think of as ag policy as defined by farm bills. The other area that's very important that I think has been neglected is the trade negotiations. The Obama administration has put increased emphasis on enforcement of past agreements, but we're sitting here with three free trade agreements that have been negotiated with Korea and Colombia and Panama that have not been pushed through ratification in the Congress. The president doesn't have trade promotion authority at the moment, and so it's hard for the U.S. negotiators to push the WTO trade negotiations forward very far, and it's going to take the president's commitment to push that process forward, and so far we haven't seen much evidence of that happening.
Yeah, so not interested in TPA or Trade Promotion Authority?
Well, it appears that there's simply not a commitment to international trade agreements. Now, the sad thing is that even though the multilateral trade negotiations going on in Geneva have been marking time now for a couple of years or more, the rest of the world is rapidly negotiating bilateral and regional trade agreements, and the whole world agricultural economy is becoming balkanized in those trading areas, and the U.S. simply isn't in the game, because nobody's going to negotiate with us as long as the president doesn't have the power to negotiate an agreement and send it to Capitol Hill for one up or down vote, which is what goes with the Trade Promotion Authority.
Yeah, President Bush didn't have TPA at the end of his tenure either, and that didn't seem to be a priority for that administration. The Obama administration doesn't seem to have a priority for TPA. Why is this the case? It doesn't.
Well, after the world financial crisis of September 2008, with the rising unemployment rates both in the U.S. as well as many other high-income countries, it became increasingly difficult to carry on trade negotiations that might liberalize international trade. Because the trade negotiations are a two-way street. We negotiate greater access to other countries' markets for things that we produce efficiently or more efficiently, but that only happens if we're willing to accept more goods from countries that can produce other things more efficiently than we can. And With 10% unemployment rate, it's just politically difficult to undergo the necessary adjustment that would go with the a trade liberalization agreement, and so we've just basically marked time.
Marked time with those bilateral agreements. The same with the WTO?
Worse than the WTO. It's stagnated during this period, including the tail end of the Bush administration. I don't think either the Bush administration or the Obama administration have given their negotiators in Geneva license to really strike deals. And as a result, they just haven't gone. They haven't gone anywhere. We're not negotiating bilateral agreements right now, but virtually everybody else in the world is. But other countries will only negotiate with us if the president gets trade promotion authority, or what used to be known as fast track authority, once again.
Is this something you would call, this lack of movement, something you would call protectionistic, and is it a problem?
Well, certainly the failure to complete the negotiations opened the door for backsliding, increasing protectionism, and we in the United States have been as guilty as that as any other country with our Buy America measures, the taxes we put on imports of tires from China, the general protectionist tone, and much more emphasis on enforcement than on negotiation.
Each and every week, those of us that follow agriculture read something about the WTO negotiations, and in particular, the cotton row between Brazil and the United States. It was, to some extent, settled last week. Can you tell me about the agreement?
Basically what Brazil alleged is that the U.S. cotton program was stimulating larger production of cotton in the U.S., which when pushed than would otherwise have occurred, then when it was pushed out into the world market, it depressed the world market prices from which Brazil's cotton growers get the entire income, because they don't have a support program down there. And WTO agreed with Brazil that U.S. cotton program was indeed doing that. It's basically the same structure as our grains and oilseeds support programs, with target prices and loan deficiency payments and countercyclical payments, direct payments. So it does raise questions about the WTO legality also of our grain and oilseeds programs. But basically, the cotton case, the U.S. should have changed the cotton program as a result of the adverse ruling in the WTO, but instead we have basically thumbed our nose at the WTO ever since then. We even wrote a new farm bill in 2008, which basically enshrined in law for another 5 years the provisions which had been found to be illegal under international trade law. And so as a result, the U.S. lost a lot of credibility in the world. Now, the agreement that Brazil struck with the U.S. last week does absolutely nothing to restore the confidence of the rest of the world in the United States' willingness to abide by the agreements that we enter into, because basically we bribe Brazil to back off, with $147 million a year support to Brazil's cotton growers. And basically bribe Brazil to back off until we write the next farm bill in 2012. But of course, if you look at what happened in 2008, with no changes in the policies that were found to be illegal under international trade law, it doesn't bode particularly well for us actually changing them in 2012 either. But this has been a real problem for the U.S. in this round of trade negotiations, because we're seen as really the bad guys, whereas in the last round of trade negotiations, the U.S. was leading the world in the direction of decoupling payments from production of specific commodities and moving to more direct payments that are less trade distorting. we did an about-face in the 2002 Farm Bill about the time the European Union had advanced a long ways down the road that we had been advocating. And so we did an about-face and continued the opposite direction in 2012, while the European Union has basically pretty much decoupled their payments from production of any specific commodities. And as a result, they're viewed as the good guys and us the bad guys in this round. And last week's cotton decision did nothing to improve that situation for us.
Well, when you look at the agreement, the $147 million is paid out yearly until the next farm bill is written and I think implemented. So that could take some time. That's not enough of an incentive, you think, for Congress to really tackle the issues when we get into the next farm bill? It seems like it says economically, we've done this once, and we might be on the hook again for $147 million yearly until if you don't change this particular law.
Oh, that's absolutely right. And Brazil is entitled to compensation as a result of our winning the case. The U.S. in the last round of trade negotiations worked hard to get a more ironclad dispute settlement process written into the WTO charter, and we got it. And of course, we have been also a victim of our own success in this cotton case. But another thing that really has turned off the rest of the world is the fact that Brazil also took a case against the European Union at the same time they took the case to the WTO against our cotton program. They took a case against the European sugar support program. The difference is when the EU also lost its case, it immediately set about reforming its sugar program. They dropped the support price 43% in the first year, set up a buyout program to buy out underappreciated assets of sugar beet growers and sugar beet processors, and the U.S. has thumbed its nose at the decision, the adverse decision against our cotton program, and the fact that we simply are not changing our program despite its inconsistency with international trade law really sends a message to the rest of the world that we're not that serious about these trade negotiations or being a good believing in the rules-based international trading system, which is what this is all about.
What do they use to say for the reasons that they have not changed the cotton program?
Is it
a security issue of some sort, or
no? It's the power of the cotton lobby. The Cotton Council is a very powerful lobby in Washington, and I sometimes semi-facetiously say that it's the most vertically integrated lobbying effort that exists in Washington. They have in one organization representing farmers, those who ship the cotton, those who gin the cotton, those who transform the cotton into garments or into cloth and then into garments, those who export the cotton. They get everybody on board, and that when you get the whole industry up and down the value-added chain integrated in one interest or one lobbying organization, they have a lot of clout. And it's simply been cotton's power that has kept the program from being changed, despite the damage it does to the U.S. reputation around the world.
You're listening to The Farming World. We're talking today with Professor Bob Thompson. He's the Gardner Endowed Chair in Agricultural Policy at the University of Illinois. More with him when we return.
Agricultural programs are made possible by Risk Management Commodities Incorporated in Lafayette, Indiana, Chalmers, Indiana, and Hudsonville, Illinois. Risk Management Commodities focuses on managing risk in today's complex and sophisticated commodities market. 866-837-9027.
This is Illinois Public Media Director of Agricultural Programming Dave Dickey. In business news, the Labor Department today says that U.S. non-farm payrolls grew at the fastest pace in 4 years in April as private sector employers ramped up hiring. Employers added 290,000 jobs in April. The unemployment rate, however, rose to 9.9% from 9.7% as the size of the labor force increased. U.S. Federal Reserve officials have agreed to sell some of the central bank's $1.1 trillion portfolio of mortgage-backed securities. However, many are undecided on how soon or how aggressively to do so. Japan is stepping up pressure against the United States in a dispute about the way the U.S. sets duties on imports it views as unfairly priced by reviving a request for sanctions at the World Trade Organization. Japan is seeking $248 million in annual retaliation against the U.S. in the case which originally involved anti-dumping duties on imports of Japanese ball bearings. And fertilizer maker CF Industries Holdings today posted a first-quarter loss and steep drop in revenue less than a month after buying rival Terra Industries. The company reported a net loss of $4.4 million, or 9 cents per share, compared with a net income of $62.7 million, or $1.28 per share in the year-earlier period. And that's a look at today's business news.
This is the Farming World from Illinois Public Media, news and interviews from the Land Grant in Urbana-Champaign. I'm U of I Extension's Todd Gleason. We're talking today with Bob Thompson. He's the Gardner Endowed Chair in Agricultural Policy at the U of I. When we left him, we were talking about WTO negotiations and the Farm Bill and what's been happening in Washington, D.C. Dr. Thompson, let's look forward to the next round of the Farm Bill negotiations, 2012. The Farm Bill should take place. What kinds of things do you expect will be on the table?
Budget deficit will be first and foremost. We're going to be writing the Farm Bill in hopefully with the U.S. economy on the rebound, but with an immense amount of or immense increase in international debt of the U.S. government. That's because basically everything we're spending in the stimulus program is being borrowed abroad. We haven't raised taxes to pay our way. Instead, we've actually, we're borrowing from people in other countries to pump all this money into the U.S. economy to get it moving again. And I think by 2012, the U.S. economy will be doing much better, and the Congress is going to have to confront the issue of how are we going to pay for the stimulus resources that we borrowed abroad. So I think that we will see the Congress being very attentive to the budget cost of the program. I think a lot of the farm organizations will try to defend the status quo, but I think that may become increasingly difficult. There was quite a bit of discussion in the last Farm Bill about what is the real problem of agriculture that justifies government involvement. And the conclusion that a lot of people came to is that it's the extremely high capital intensity of our farm sector that's financed principally with debt financing as opposed to equity financing, so that it's extremely vulnerable to volatility in total revenue. And as a result, the notion of some form of a government subsidy to a revenue insurance program instead of the hodgepodge of sometimes conflicting and often overlapping programs that we have. There are at least five programs that support corn and beans and cotton and the other program crops. We have countercyclical payments, loan deficiency payments, direct payments, a big subsidy to crop insurance, and also disaster payments that are made to states that have natural disasters. And what people are saying is, let's insure the product of price times yield revenue rather than ensuring yield and or price as we have in the past. There's also a big issue about direct payments. Chairman Peterson, chairman of the House Ag Committee, has already expressed what you're hearing many quarters, that maybe we ought to take the money that we're spending for direct payments and use that as agriculture's contribution to deficit reduction. The problem with that, of course, is that flies in the face of everything that the U.S. advocated in the last round of WTO trade negotiations, as well as in this round. The whole tone of those negotiations has been to shift support away from production of specific commodities to direct payments that are decoupled from production of any specific commodity. So do we redesign our commodity programs into a more consistent revenue insurance programs? They take the money we're spending in all five support areas and pool it and focus the resources on what's the real problem of modern agriculture in the United States, or we... can we make it consistent with the WTO trade agreements or trade negotiations? And, of course, just the pure budget cost of the program is also going to be a big deal.
If you were to do that, which of the programs should survive those five, or should there be different ones developed?
What seems to me, it would make most sense to take everything we're spending on loan deficiency payments, countercyclical payments, direct payments, subsidies to crop insurance, and disaster payments, some of which focus on price, some of which focus on yield, some focus on revenue, pool those resources and focus it on the real problem. Now, the other alternative, what the Europeans have done, is they took everything they were spending on all those types of programs, put it in the pot, divided it by the number of acres in farm production, and then make an annual acreage payment to farmers as long as they satisfy some conservation cross-compliance rules. They call it basically paying farmers for providing environmental services. That's neutral with respect to what you grow, because it doesn't matter what you grow on the land to qualify for the payment. It's whether or not you follow good conservation measures. That's advocated by some environmental groups in the United States to the extent that they feel that agriculture should be subsidized at all.
Dr. Thompson, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Bob Thompson from early in the month of April. He's an agricultural policy specialist at the University of Illinois. Thanks for being along with us this afternoon for this encore edition of Illinois Public Media's The Farming World. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.